With my double-bladed axe and my hobnail boots, I go where the timber's tall. When there's work to be done, don't mess around, just sing right out for call.
Okay, well, we're all familiar with that version of Paul Bunyan. That's the Disney version, by the way, in case you're wondering. But did you know that that version of Paul Bunyan was originally created for a lumber company advertisement? Because Paul Bunyan had a dark side, too. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. And here to talk about the myths and the real lives of lumberjacks is Willa Hammett Brown, the author of the new book, Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack. What questions or comments do you have about logging or lumberjacks? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Willa, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jill.
You bet. You know, it was kind of funny when I first started reading your book. I'm like, wow, she's got the same kind of background as I do. I had a great-grandfather who was a lumberjack who came in from Canada, not Scandinavia like yours did. So it was very interesting for me to read your book. But let's just talk first about that whole Paul Bunyan thing. I know you don't really get to it till later on, but I think people are probably intrigued. It's like, what do you mean that Paul Bunyan had a dark side? So tell us about that.
Absolutely. So Paul Bunyan is totally fascinating to me, and in some ways extra special American because of this, because he is often cited as sort of the great American folk hero. There have been operas written about him. He was the decoration for World's Fair American stands, but he's a commercial invention, which that just feels very American to me. So Paul Bunyan did exist in a few stories in the late 19th century. The earliest written story of him is from about 1890. And that Paul Bunyan was a jerk. He was real mean. He was nothing like the sort of Disneyfied version. The first story that ever was circulated and printed about him was one called The Round River Drive, where he just made his men take logs around and around and around and around the same river so that he would never have to pay them. So that's not the lumberjack we know and love. And it was a researcher at the Wisconsin Historical Society, which a lot of my research was in Wisconsin, the great state of. I live in Minnesota, but I have nothing but respect for our neighbors. A man named Michael Edmonds, who was an archivist there, who really turned me on to looking at the roots of lumber of Paul Bunyan and where he came from. And his first popularization was as an ad for the Red River Lumber Company. A man named William Lawhead had worked a bit in the camps, had heard a bunch of tall tales, and he sort of collected them, sanitized them, and put Paul Bunyan, slapped him on them, and made this cheerful, sweet guy, sometimes a little bumbling, but mostly good-hearted, with his beautiful, like, gang of lumberjacks out in the woods having a good time. And that's the one that took over. And it meant that we, in the wake of that, erased a lot of the real history of what those men had been like and how they had been seen. Because instead we had this easy, friendly symbol that we all became very familiar with.
And it's still out there. There's a lot of places where that, well, for some reason he kept growing. This huge Paul Bunyan is out there to greet vacationers in most cases, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All over sort of the three states I worked on were Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. But there are also Paul Bunyans in California, in Washington State, in Maine, anywhere where lumber was huge. And then I sort of think of Paul Bunyan as standing in for this whole phenomenon of lumberjacks that might not be specifically Paul Bunyan. But you think about the brawny paper towel guy, or the lumberjack that's in the ads for the Duluth Trading Company. Or if my favorite, the only reason the Monty Python Lumberjack song is so funny is because we quote unquote know what real lumberjacks were like. And so it makes it hilarious that they press wildflowers and wear suspenders and a bra because we have this idea of what they're like.
Right, exactly. I thought it was interesting too that where was I going with this? Well, actually, we've got a call. Let's go to a call first, and maybe I'll remember what I was going to say. Stephen Rhinelander, go right ahead.
Good morning. My great-grandfather left home at age 14 in 1884 when his mother died and moved to northern Wisconsin to work in the woods. And the next three generations were northern Wisconsin loggers. I still own family land in Price County. Every time I go up north, I can't help but see the damage to the land and the rivers. And I wanted to thank the author for her skill and courage in speaking the truth about the history here. I still love and respect my ancestors, but I want my kids to know they were exploited Eastern European immigrants, and just only a few people got super rich.
Mm-hmm. Truth, for
absolutely.
Sure.
And that's what so much of the sort of Paul Bunyan myth covers over, is it makes us think of it as this sort of small-scale friendly industry, when really it looked so much more like Western mining or oil rigs or any of these extractive industries that we know were exploitative and we know were super centralized and we know had a bottom layer of workers who had no hope of moving up. But that industry kind of got disappeared, and so did, as you say, that incredible environmental damage. We don't talk or think about the logging of this region as one of the greatest environmental reshapings and disasters in American history. Also, I'm so glad somebody from Rhinelander called. I don't know if you know that you are the home of the Hodag.
Oh, they know.
I've never actually been to Rhinelander myself, but as soon as I heard the name, I was thrilled.
There's a lovely statue, and there used to be Hodag days. I'm not sure if there still is, but oh yeah, they know.
They're aware.
They're very aware. The Hodag. Yeah, we can talk a little bit about that, too, because you do mention that in your book. And what I was going to ask you about earlier that I completely spaced, conservation. So we've got Paul Bunyan, who's, you know, looking like a conservationist, representing a group of organizations, mm-hmm. people, whatever, that clear cut so many acres of land. In my mind, I never thought about that. It's like, why are we talking about this person who obviously, you know, cut down all these trees, but he's always surrounded by them and everything we hear and see. So was that kind of a surprise to you too? Had you really thought about it before?
I had absolutely not thought about it before. And it becomes this really prevalent image when this region starts selling itself as a tourist destination. Because the thing is, you can't sell as a tourist destination what the Northwoods looked like in 1900, 1910, which is just miles of stumps. But you also can't really deny that the logging industry existed. And this sort of Paul Bunyan-y lumberjack manages to bridge that gap. It manages to make it look like lumberjacks existed and logged here, but they never destroyed their woods. They were part of the woods. They were more working with the woods, like sailors and the sea or farmers and the land, this sort of organic connection. And the truth of the matter is everything we see up north now is second growth forest. In Minnesota, for instance, there is only one 40-acre plot of original white pine stand in the entire state. It only exists because there was an accident in a surveying trip and it was surveyed as under a lake. And so no one could buy the rights to it. But that's it. That's it. And so you start seeing in the 50s and 60s, this sort of come see the virgin wilderness untouched by any human hands. And yet they're advertising on the same thing. They'll say untouched. And then they'll have a lumberjack and a sort of stereotypical Native American standing in for the Menominee or the Anishinaabe. And there's this weird dichotomy that exists in the American mind around things like cowboys and lumberjacks, and that is similar to what exists around Native Americans, which is this idea we have that they could be both, the land could be occupied by people but untouched by man.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff to uncover in that particular conversation. But let's go to Carol in Appleton, and she has something for us. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi. Back in the 1980s, like early 80s, I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. And one of my volunteer opportunities, I visited a woman who was about 100 back then in a nursing home. And she used to tell me the best stories. And one of her stories was that at Stevens Point, the town, the loggers would come down from up north and cash their checks. And she said it was like the Wild West. When they would come into town, I guess there were gunfights and they had brothels, and it was a pretty happening place to be.
Yes. Oh, Carol, I'm so glad you brought that up. And it's so fun to hear of somebody having those memories. I have heard those memories all secondhand through largely WPA interviews that were done in the 1930s. But it was there, a man named Jeremy Kalar did some studies and found that the Michigan lumber towns were as violent, if not more violent, than the Wild West cow towns. And what you're describing was nicknamed the Spree, which was, logging was always done in the winter because before we had steam power and gas power in the woods, we were using horses, which meant sliding on ice was the only way to move these enormous logs. And then when it thawed, they would come into town, and the descriptions are like some sort of wild natural phenomenon. They talk about them as like locusts, that there was nothing you could do about it. A lot of people would say the only thing to do was just lock your doors and stay inside, because they were going to come, they were going to spend their money. And what eventually towns did as they were trying to make themselves more and more respectable is they start building neighborhoods to try to contain them. They sort of think of them as you can't stop it, and it's going to infect the morals of the town, these terrible, terrible men, which again, now we're seeing that real contrast with Paul Bunyan. But these awful men are going to infect the morals of the town. So they build basically quarantine zones. In fact, the term skid row as a bad part of town comes from a logging term. A skid row is part of a camp. It's where the logs are skidded down to the lake. And those areas were just full of brothels and taverns, and largely the police let what happened happen as long as it didn't come into the rest of the town. So yeah, we don't get much of that sense anymore. A lot of people in those towns tried to cover it up. There's a bunch of great angry newspaper letters in the 1940s about Seney, Michigan. This guy saying there wasn't a single prostitute in all of the Upper Peninsula. No, there were so many. So many.
That anyone would believe that is beyond me. And you'd mentioned Seney, and that's not too far from where I grew up, but there's like not much of anything left there. But at one point, there were a lot of people there, all because of the lumber industry, right?
Seney was really fun for me to visit. That was one of my favorite research stops. It is it comes up in story after story after story. And then when you go to Seney now, I don't think there's even a stoplight at the crossroads. And there, you know, there's a gas station, a couple stores. I went to see their historical museum, and it involved going to the county office and then being sent to a gym and finding this one guy who had the key. But what I loved, because these towns were so small, this was really fun. I was in the Seney Historical Museum, and I'm looking at these photos. And there's a photo of the Women's Woodwind Society. This is sort of, you know, respectable middle class, all these ladies sitting in their proper little band. And then in a different part, there's a photo of sort of the worst row of town where all the brothels were. And there are these women waving from the top floor of hotels. And wouldn't you know, some of them are the same women. But the town was too small for you to put together a woodwind band without a few prostitutes in it.
Right. There was a lot of stuff like that in your book that I found quite interesting, entertaining, and really kind of funny in a sad way. And their pictures are wonderful. There's a lot of really nice pictures in there, and there's a couple of sections with full color. Mm-hmm. But how did you find all those really interesting pictures, and how did you maybe even filter out some of them? Because I'm sure you found a lot more.
So huge amounts of credit here has to go to my editor, Christian Tvedin at the University of Minnesota Press. He has a background in art history, and he got very excited about the images with me. And I would say in the end, while I came to him with images, probably only 20% of the images in the book are ones that I brought to him. The rest are ones he brought to me. He kept finding all of these incredible images. A lot of them are from the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Historical Society just have these incredible banks of images. And I also used images a lot in research. My research method is I should never give grad students advice. I was getting my PhD, and they sort of say, you know, to carefully get this narrow question and then find the three archives you're going to go to. And my question was lumberjacks? Question mark. And my sources were like anything. So I used a lot of images, and images are really fun to work with because they tell stories that you don't get in the words, especially when you're working with a group like lumberjacks who are largely illiterate and largely despised in their own time. We don't write a lot about that kind of person. So it's both a huge challenge and a lot of fun to try to get at the lives of people who were not written about.
We're talking with Willa Hammett Brown. She's an historian, speaker, and writer, and the author of the new book, Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question or comment. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up at noon, the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin is another name they go by, return to talk about why we experience wild weather every spring. That's coming up at noon. Right now, we are talking about lumberjacks. And let's go to Kay in Maryland, Wisconsin. Go right ahead, Kay.
Hey. Maryland was started as a lumber town. The guy that came here, seen all the forest and thought, oh my God, I could be rich. So my question is, from our area in Jackson County over to Rapids, down to the Dells area, that was the nesting area for the passenger pigeons. And then they clear cut. And that is supposed to be why we no longer have passenger pigeons, why they went extinct. Is that true?
Have you did any kind of looking into that at all, Willa?
I haven't looked specifically into the passenger pigeons. What's very funny to me right now is that my uncle wrote a book called Pigeons and People about the extinction of the passenger pigeon. And I read it when I was about 12. So I'm trying to remember. But what I can tell you that the ecological disaster of that region did lead to a lot of extinctions of species and did lead to a lot of migratory patterns of species having to change. The scale of the lumbering is really, really hard to imagine or understand just because we haven't done anything like it. And that part of sort of central Wisconsin was the most devastated of the entire region. In fact, people don't talk about it a lot, but in the late 1920s, early 1930s, there was a second smaller dust bowl than the one in Oklahoma in Wisconsin. And during the 1930s, even though only about 10% of the population of Wisconsin lived in the area, over 75% of government aid was going to that area because it had been so ecologically devastated by this industry. And also by it, as the industry receded, they attempted to sell the land, and they sold it through a lot of lies. And one of those lies was that all of this was the most beautiful, the richest farmland. But the thing is, pines grow in sandy soil. So if there were a lot of pines there, then you're not going to have soil that's good for a lot other than pines. And you're also going to loosen that soil when you cut down the pines. You're going to lose those root systems. And so we lost huge areas, vast swaths of these regions, to dust bowls and fires throughout the, really starting in the 1870s and going all the way through the 1930s.
And let's talk about the result of that in another area, which is wildfires. Yeah. They were devastating, and I know here in Wisconsin, of course, we know about the Peshtigo Fire. Why don't you talk a little bit about those fires and the effects of logging and why that happened?
Yeah, I mean, outside Wisconsin, a huge number of people have never heard of Peshtigo, which Peshtigo is to this day the deadliest fire in American history. Historians disagree. Early claims were that it claimed 1,200 lives. Estimates go up as high as 3,000 lives. It happened to happen the same day as the Great Chicago Fire. So it kind of got swept aside by history because while Chicago actually destroyed a far smaller area and killed many fewer people, it was flashier. It was Chicago. And Peshtigo got swept aside, but if you look at it still, 4 out of the 10 deadliest fires in American history were during this region in this area. The Thumb Fire in Michigan, there were the Cloquet Fire in Minnesota. And a lot of these fires, they got blamed at the time on either accident or blamed on people doing bad protocol and leaving too many logs piled here or there. But really, even if you had a big pile of drying logs by a railroad, which is how it often started with a railroad spark, the problem was that as the industry went, they would clear cut and anything that wasn't worth saving, they would just leave. And so you have these miles and miles of drying slash, and those would catch fire incredibly quickly and in devastating, huge fires that covered overall an area almost the size of Delaware burned over this sort of 40-year period. So these enormous, enormous wildfires that absolutely devastated the region and yet have been kind of misplaced in history. I didn't learn about them until I started studying this myself. You know, and that was, I have a PhD in American history, and it wouldn't have come up if it weren't for the fact that I was studying this particular region myself.
Let's go back to the phones. Todd in De Pere, go ahead, please.
Hi, good morning. Looking forward to reading your book. I want to talk about two publications. One, my mother-in-law found at a rummage sale. It's The Forestry Primer by the American Tree Association from 1876 to 1926. And it speaks of basically the turning point to modern forestry practices. And it does mention the forest fires in the United States, which just dwarfed even the large fires in California. The other book I'd like to mention, very hard to find, an old book, is called A Wisconsin Lumberman Looks Backwards by William Holt. They own a lumber company in O'Connell, and they speak a lot of areas in northern Wisconsin, which are dear to my heart. I used to live up there, and I recognize a lot of the old names. Just an interesting, interesting publication, an interesting book. If you can find.
Thank you, Todd. We really appreciate that. Are those new to you, Willa?
The Wisconsin Lumberman Looks Backward, I have seen. The Forestry Primer is new to me. That is the sort of key moment of change. And the first change was as small as changing the way teeth worked on a saw that allowed saws to go much faster, cross-cut saws. And then really the change comes with mechanization, with the introduction of steam engines. So you're using trains instead of rivers. And then eventually you're using tractors instead of horses. And that changes the game entirely. If people want to read the sort of original sources and get a sense of it, one that is better available is a book called Holy Old Mackinaw. And that is written by a lumberman looking sort of back at his own experience and can be a fun way into the more colorful details. Although I will say that I pulled a lot of the most colorful details I could find and put them in the book. There's a section where I describe the smell of a logging camp that has been described to me by one of my best friends as visceral and by my uncle as nauseating. So I tried to keep some of that detail there in the book.
Well, you got to describe what one of those logging camps was like so people can probably get into their mind what it actually smelled like.
Oh, yeah. Bad. I mean, that was bad. So if you're talking about the height of it, at the very early on, camps would be very small. They would be an owner clearing a plot with 5 or 6 men helping them out. But by the time we get to sort of industrial scale logging, the camps had proliferated into a sort of set number of buildings. There would be a cook shack where the men would eat. They would normally have about 15 minutes a meal. Lunch was brought to them where they were cutting. So it would be breakfast before dawn and dinner after nightfall, no talking, 15 minutes in and out. The cooks were really revered because almost all the camps paid the same. So men, the only reason they'd stay is if they were treated well, because there was normally more work than men. So a lot of them would vote with their feet if the cook was bad and just go find another camp. Then there would be a hut where the scaler, the sort of educated men of the camp, so the foreman and the people who did the counting and the numbers lived. There'd be a blacksmith. And then there would be the main shanty, and it would have somewhere between 50 and 120 men. They would sleep in long bunks side to side, sometimes with sort of single blankets covering a dozen of them, big long blankets. The smell part comes from the fact that, first of all, some men were known to put on their long underwear at the beginning of winter and take it off at the end and never in between. And at the end of a day, you would come back and your socks would be wet. So they would hang those over. There'd be a big iron stove in the middle for heating, and you'd hang your socks there. So you just have to imagine 100 pairs of wet socks steaming into a poorly ventilated space with 100 unwashed men bedding down for the night. And you begin to get a sense of how deeply unpleasant these conditions were.
Especially when you remember they were out all day sweating profusely. Mm-hmm. So, yep. Yes, absolutely. Let's go to Jerry in Prairie du Chien. Go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you for accepting my call. I've just tuned in late, but I wondered if your guest knew about the Bermuda Triangle of northern Wisconsin. Namely, it was called Hurley, Hayward, and Hell.
I know Hurley, Hayward. I know that area. I have not heard it called the Bermuda Triangle. I love that. There are these regions in each state. So I sort of think of Hurley, Wisconsin being the Sini of Wisconsin. And then Minnesota, it's sort of around Deer River, which is where actually I've spent every summer of my life and now is a town of 800 and perfectly respectable. But Hurley and Hayward were some of the roughest Wisconsin towns, just filled with lumberjacks and filled with the brothels that held these sprees, taverns and brothels. And those are also areas, a lot of them, that now have reclaimed that as a real point of pride. Hayward is where the World Lumberjack Games are. So these areas have now really come to reclaim it. But at the time, they were not exactly respectable. And the year-round citizens were doing anything they could to try to keep the lumberjacks either out of town or at least contained where they were safe. And they could just fight each other and not get into the town.
And Jerry, did you have a comment about a logging antique that you have?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my uncle was aware of at least an old logging site in Douglas County, and there he found a Copenhagen snuff jar. It's out of a croc material, like the same type of material that the Red Wing crocs are made out of, and he gifted that to me. It's about 5 inches tall and in very pale blue print, still visible on the jar, is the name Copenhagen. So I'm very fond of that. Just not that I use tobacco, but it was a gift from my favorite uncle, and I'm happy to have it.
Thank you, Jerry.
Heirloom.
Right? Yeah, for sure. Let's go to Ann in Madison. Go ahead, Ann.
Hi. My grandfather and his brother Pete were both lumberjacks up somewhere in northern Wisconsin, and my grandmother was a cook in that camp. Boucha and Grandpa married, and Grandpa and his father built their house, and they lived there their whole life. In Edgar, Grandpa used to tell us stories of Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox, and Paul Bunyan, he said, was buried, and his feet are where Rib Mountain is.
That's so fun. Thank you, Ann. I appreciate that. My grandmother was a cook in a lumber camp, too, when she was quite young. That was in the 20s, though. So things were changing at that point. So talk a little bit about that. So we've got the very early part where you had mentioned that there were smaller tracks that were being taken down. And then the lumber barons came in. So what happened at that point and after?
So when the lumber barons come in, the very early things are people are either buying small tracts of land or they're straight stealing it from the Anishinaabe and the Menominee with assumptions that they could get away with it. And they were successful in doing so. And you could go in with very little capital to start up. By the 1890s, you're buying up bigger and bigger tracts of land. Several treaties have essentially wrested control of almost all the indigenous owned land. The Menominee were actually really successful at keeping a patch of land and logging it themselves. The Anishinaabe didn't have a centralized leadership and got swindled harder. And so you start having men come in with a lot of capital in order to, if you think about it, I'm describing that early camp, you have a little log cabin with 12 guys. If you need to build four or five buildings, including having a fully working cook shack and a fully working smithy, you need a lot more money. And so it gets centralized and they get bigger and bigger. And then in about 1916, really, is when labor unrest starts. And you start having at the same time more ability to use tractors in the woods, and it really changes. So by 1920, the men would be sleeping on beds with springs. There are a lot of great memoirs and stories of people in the 1930s talking about, you know, these young bucks, they're so soft. They're not real lumberjacks. They have springs on their bed. They have running water. They wash every day. That's not a real lumberjack. And you have much more control from the top, these multiple camps owned by one person. And that's when you really get, starting in sort of the 1880s, when it starts being more or less impossible to sort of bootstrap your way up from the bottom to the top. If you're at the bottom of the structure and working as a jack, you're not going to end up owning.
A lot of times, and sometimes they own the towns where the logs came in. That was the case where I grew up. And when the trees were pretty much gone, they sold the town. So very, very interesting. Thomas in Manitowoc, go right ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to know what time of year did these guys start logging, and when did they usually end? Because my grandfather, he was a home builder, and in the winter back in the old days, he was off, and he would go back up north and lumberjack. It's from what I understand, it wasn't that long of a season because they had to float the logs down the rivers when the water was high, and it's amazing they could cut all those trees down in that short of a season.
Yeah, the seasons were quite short. The camp would be built before the freeze, but men would be sent up as soon as snow was on the ground. We have to remember that these last few winters are climate change winters, so that was earlier than it would be now, but still at the earliest late October, mid-October. And then they would pile the logs next to the river, and as soon as the river ice broke up, and the water was high, as you say, those logs would be shoved in for the drive, which was the last part of the season. So you could start work early if you were building the camp, but then a jack would work from sort of mid-October until the spring breakup, and then river pigs, they were called, would take over, which were sometimes lumberjacks, sometimes not. And they would do the drive, which was the most dangerous, but also the best paid part of the process. And then those men would go do something else. And a lot of lumberjacks sort of believed that a true lumberjack didn't go back to a farm in his family. Those were guys who might spend a winter or two. But instead, somebody might go to house building. A lot of them would do what was called grass backing, which was to go out to the Dakotas and work on farms. And then they would come back and show up in cities in the fall and wait to be sent back out to the camps.
It's a crazy life for sure. I mean, that we kind of get, like you had mentioned, hobos and tramps and what were the other one that what was the, there was three of them, right? Hobos, tramps, I'm not going to say thieves. But anyway, that's kind of where that comes from, right? Is that these itinerant workers are just kind of going all over the country.
Yeah, and itinerant workers then, and I think notably now, were blamed for a lot of things. The idea, especially in the late 19th century, was that men have these sort of dangerous natural urges, and the thing that keeps them safe and respectable is their self-restraint, which was very, very important, and family, women, wives, mothers, daughters. And so transient workers were really distrusted because the idea was that they had no attachment to the community and they might do anything. And I think you can really see that these ideas have not gone away. The workers were considered racially other. Notably, whiteness here and race has nothing to do with skin color. I have a letter from a guy named Glenn Horace writing home to his mom that there were 15 white men and 60 Swedes in his camp. So, you know, the idea that Scandinavians or Eastern Europeans were sort of racially other, unassimilable, and passing through with no wives, no families to restrain them. And I think you can look at the way we talk about migrant workers today and see a lot of parallels in this scapegoating and fear that these people aren't committed enough to the community and might therefore be a danger.
I thought that was interesting, too, because when we think of migrants, obviously in this time frame, we think of other people than we do people from Sweden or Finland or Denmark or what have you. So it kind of just shows the different ways that we look at these things. Let's talk a little bit about the Native American tribes that were affected by this land grab, number one, and that some of them actually did work with the companies.
Yeah, absolutely. The Anishinaabe were probably the most affected and the most likely to be in camps. The land grab was devastating and went through several stages. Some of them were treaties to buy, and then eventually you get what is still remembered among the Ojibwe Anishinaabe as the White Earth Tragedy, which is there was this new reservation created called White Earth, and then the Dawes Act in 1882 said, we can't hold this land in common. Everybody has to get a plot. But each plot was not big enough to make a living off. So then those plots were sold off to timbermen because they couldn't actually support a family. The way the Anishinaabe interacted with the camps is actually really interesting to me in a couple of ways. From the Anishinaabe point of view, it sort of fit into an existing economy, which is there's an annual round that had been burying, hunting, ricing, fishing, and moving from different areas to take advantage of each of those abilities. And in the winter, as land was taken and the ability to hunt was lost, a lot of men would go and work in the camps and then bring that money back to a more communal economy among the Anishinaabe. So sort of replacing hunting with this inflow of capital from the camps. The other thing I found really, or a thing I found really interesting was the attitudes within the camps, the relationships between Yankee settlers, European immigrants, and the Anishinaabe, which was this sort of racial hierarchy in which the Anishinaabe were always at the bottom. And you see actually a lot of, in racializing, especially the Finns, they would be called Finnish Indians and sort of always placed at this bottom of the scale. And a lot of that scale was determined by skills. Sort of they thought white men were the best workers because they could learn these skills. And the assumption was Anishinaabe were good in the woods, not because they were skilled, which they were, but instead because there was something natural to indigenous people that made them good at being in the woods. So this wasn't a learned skill the way it was for a Yankee. It was instead just the natural ability of someone they considered closer to nature anyway. And so any skill was sort of discounted and put to the side. So it was a really interesting relationship and a deeply tragic story of land and economic loss that's only now, with a lot of land reclamation work being done by the Anishinaabe and the White Earth in particular, beginning to slowly be reversed.
Okay. We are speaking with Willa Hammett Brown. She's the author of the book Gentlemen in the Woods, Manhood Myth and the American Lumberjack. If you have any questions, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najeau. Coming up at noon, the weather guys are back, and we're going to talk about why our weather is so up and down in the spring. It's coming up after the news at noon. Right now, we are talking about Gentlemen of the Woods, Manhood, Myth, and the American Lumberjack with Willa Hammett Brown, its author. And we've got a couple people who want to talk to us. So go ahead, Amy in Madison. Amy, are you there? I don't think so. Okay, let's go on to Oscar in Barron County.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, my dad worked in as a lumberjack for, he said, for three winters. And he was born in 1889. And he never talked a whole lot about it, but he said that he got paid $25 a month. And he worked for 3 months in the winter, and they were expected to be at the site where they were cutting by daylight and didn't leave until dark. And they made $25 a month for 6 days a week. And I assume it was somewhere in about 1920 because he got married in 1921, and I know he said that he spent his whole winter's income to buy a new wedding suit. And so that's why I think it was somewhere around 1921 that he worked as a logger.
Wow, that's a lot of work for one wedding suit.
Yes. That's also, you know, it's around 1920 because about 15 years earlier than that, it would have been less money still. It was about $3.50 to $4 a week. And there were also camps where the term, lumbering has so many fun terms that made their way into our world, but some camps wouldn't pay if they didn't make the contract, if they didn't cut enough wood. So you would have been working just for food, which is where the phrase working for beans comes from.
I saw that and I thought that was so interesting that it did come from there. Speaking of food, we have visions of these lumberjacks being fed all this wonderful food so they could work all day. Your book says no, that's not necessarily the case, was it?
It was a lot of calories. Whether or not it was wonderful is another thing. I mean, you're talking about camps that are often 10, 12 miles from the closest town, and it's sort of once a week or once every 2 weeks, a supply sled is coming through. So things like fresh meat and fresh vegetables really aren't much on the menu. You do get salt meat. There would be meat because it was sort of needed. But in the morning, they have all sorts of wonderful words, sweat pads, which are pancakes. and you would drink that. You'd have your sweat pads washed down with swamp water or blackjack, coffee or tea. Swamp water is tea, blackjack's coffee. And you might have donuts called cold shuts after they're shaped like a certain kind of link in a chain. So a lot of these sort of big carby foods in the morning. At lunch, a wagon called a swing dingle would come out to the woods with a stew normally, or pies, raisin pies usually, or just sort of what we'd call a chess pie now, just a sweet molasses filling. And then dinner would be meat and potatoes. So it's a lot of food. The average lumberjack was consuming between 3,000 and 4,000 calories a day, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily a lot of food you'd want. Especially the further from town you were, you're not exactly getting your winter greens in.
That's for sure. At least they were getting vitamin D out there in the forest every day. Let's go to Stuart in Minneapolis. Go ahead, Stuart.
Hi, I'm calling about a children's picture book. I read with kids at a local school, and this was a good find. It's called Marvin of the North Woods, and the book was done by the granddaughter of Marvin, who at the age of 10 years old lived in Duluth, a Jewish family, and in order to put him out of harm's way from the influenza epidemic, his father, through a connection, had him spend several months way up north at mostly French-speaking lumberjack camp. And it's a lovely view into the life of the lumberjack through the experiences of a 10-year-old city kid. And he keeps kosher, so he works out a very clever way to deal with the diet. And he's clever in arithmetic, so he keeps the books. And he's befriended by the biggest and toughest lumberjack of all. So
that sounds like a great little book.
It sounds like a wonderful book. And I am in Minneapolis, wonderful city, in a Jewish family. So this is all a bunch of stuff I want to know more about.
There you go.
You.
It sounds perfect for you. Richard in Madison emailed to say that when he was a youngster growing up in Eau Claire during the 1950s, their Sunday school teacher, Lois Barland, wrote the book Sawdust City about Eau Claire's origins as a lumber mill town on the banks of the Chippewa River. Half Moon Lake and Oxbow Lake formed by the river was a kind of holding pen for the thousands of logs floated down river from further north in the state. When Richard went to college, he worked summers at the local paper mill, still a growing concern at the time.
Yeah, and Eau Claire was right near one of my favorite moments, the Battle of Beef Slaw, it was a place, it just happens to have a great name, but these boom companies who would hold the logs and sort them. And it was a real moment in the 1880s, and Eau Claire was at the heart of it, when the small companies go up against the big concerns, and the big concerns managed to get state government and police behind them, and really they worked together to kind of create a group company that drove all the smaller concerns out of business. So that's all really in the Eau Claire region.
Mm-hmm. Amy in Madison, you're up next. Go ahead. Amy, are you there? Oh.
Are you asking for Arnie?
Oh, I'm sorry. Arnie, yes. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I have just a bit of information, a little anecdote about Finnish logging camps. When my grandfather immigrated from Finland, he arrived in Duluth in 1910. And then after he had worked a few months, he sent enough money so my grandmother could join him. I'm on Lynn. They could join him and join. And then they were recruited by a Finnish logging camp owner who then brought them to his logging camp about 65 miles west of Duluth. And she worked as a cook, and my grandfather's a lumberjack. The one difference, though, on the Finnish-operated logging camps is that there was always a sauna, so that the bathing situation was much improved over most of them. Even if it was a temporary building or whatever, they always had that. So that made it a very different and valuable sort of resource for Finnish immigrants who were logging.
Absolutely. And a lot of the Finns, a lot of the labor unrest in 1916, the big strike, was organized out of the Finnish Socialist Opera House. And a lot of the Finns took real exception because they were always placed as sort of the lowest of the low and looked down on by everybody. And they would point out, we are the only clean ones. wherever a Finn goes, there's a sauna.
Right.
And they were furious about the sort of racist attitude towards them because they thought everybody else was pretty much disgusting.
Thank you, Arnie. We really appreciate it. Anne emailed to ask how many of the lumberjacks were French-Canadian in Chippewa Falls, for example, and how many of the others were Canadians, I guess? I'm not quite sure what she means. But, we talked about Scandinavians, and we had talked about French-Canadians, but what were the mixes up there?
Yeah, Jill, you're from the Canadian part. So the early camps were Yankee stock. They would talk about themselves as Yankee. And that mostly meant they came from somewhere in the northeast of the United States or French Canadians. And then as time went on, the immigration first was a lot were coming from Germany and then eventually the Scandinavians. And then the final wave was really Slavs coming from Eastern Europe.
Okay, wonderful. I hate to cut you off there, but we really do have to break it off. Thank you so much, Willa. This was so much fun. We'd love to talk to you again. So thank you for being with us. Willa's book is Gentlemen of the Woods, Manhood Myth, and the American Lumberjack.
When it was night, he walked back over the stumps he cut and stomped them out of sight. Hey, Paul,
I'm coming, boys.
Paul Bunyan.
Well, thunderstorms and other severe weather are common every spring in Wisconsin. But why? Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. And who can answer that question better than the weather guys? Good thing they're back with us. John Martin is a professor and former chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and I'm sure he'll be here any minute. And Steve Ackerman is the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. And Steve is also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. What weather questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. John, thanks for being here, and hopefully Steve is on his way. Or I'm the other way around. Hi, Steve. Hopefully John is on his way.
I am sure he is. He's teaching in a classroom, and so I'm sure he's running here now.
That's right, and we appreciate him doing that because it's like cross campus, right?
And it is, and he's a great teacher as well, so I'm sure the classroom's try and keep him there and talk more and more about the weather and what's going on.
Kind of like Indiana Jones, I'll bet.
Sort of like that. That's right. Although he doesn't have that hat.
He doesn't have that hat. Maybe we need to talk to him about that.
About that, right. Yeah, get rid of that Boston baseball cap
and put it on a cool hat. Right. Anyway, weather. Okay. You know, it was really beautiful this weekend, and today I've got my winter coat back out. Why are we so up and down in the spring?
In the springtime, you know, march in like a lion, not like a lamb. Although on Friday it may have seemed like for southern Wisconsin, Madison hit a record high temperature.
Did we?
77, I think it was.
Oh, my gosh.
78.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, that whole saying, that folklore saying, one of the aspects of that is associated with the variability that we typically have in March. Although, if you live in northern Wisconsin with the ice storm that they had up there, I'm sure they are not thinking the end of March is acting like a lamb and being very passive.
Is that changing since we've had all these weather changes?
No, not really. In the sense that, you know, March and April, think about March, it's at the end of the winter, and so we're dealing with potential of winter storms at the beginning of the month. Which we can still get at the end of the month, and we can also get that in April. It's just likely.
I think that is in the forecast for the state, actually.
It's getting
tonight,
more snowfall.
Tomorrow.
Right, yeah. And that's what it is. I mean, we're entering, you know, the summertime type convection or springtime, late springtime.
And what causes that? Is that a jet stream thing?
So the jet stream, where the jet stream is located, tends to support where convection occurs. You want to have an unstable atmosphere as well. And you need to have the sun up to heat the surface as well. And so by the time we're getting into April, all of those things beginning to line up. Doesn't mean they can't line up in January. In fact, we did have thunderstorms this past January as well.
Yes,
so
we
can have weather, I don't know, almost any kind of weather at almost any time, except maybe, I guess I wouldn't go with snowfall in summer, but
don't
say
it too loud.
Right?
You just never know these days. Well, it keeps us on our toes, right?
That's true.
Yes.
And that's what we want. Weather is very important to us, and our ability to predict it is also very important.
Very much so. So I just heard through Joel, our producer here, that every year spring is 30 seconds shorter than the year before. And then that means that every summer is 30 seconds longer and that this has been happening for thousands of years. And nobody told me. Why does this happen?
And I think you wouldn't notice it unless you were an astronomer. Look at that. And I think the issue that's going on here is a couple of things. One is the, you know, when we have our summer, our axis in the northern hemisphere is pointing towards the sun. But that wobbles around. It's not all that uniform. And the way that it's been wobbling is that it's now been occurring 30 seconds earlier, which means that we're taking some time away, if you will, from the springtime. The other thing that's going on is that the Earth is not in a circular orbit. It's in an elliptical orbit. And so when we're farther away from the sun, the Earth is moving slower. And so that occurs in our northern hemisphere summer. And so the axis is moving a little bit earlier, and the Earth is rotating a little bit slower, and that makes the summer 30 seconds longer, a little bit longer, which takes time away from spring. And apparently winter. I guess winter is getting shorter. But like you said, we're not going to notice it.
We're not going to notice it. We don't even have a winter here anymore.
Oh, he sounds so disappointed.
I am disappointed.
John's a snowstorm kind of guy.
So when you retire, you're moving to Antarctica? Or
no, I don't have any control over that, Joel. I'll probably be staying exactly right here and watching the winters disappear even more. I hope I'm wrong.
So you're going to be that complaining old guy on the porch.
I already am. Yeah. That a long time ago.
So now you're talking about that wiggle thing. Now, is that the opposite then for the southern hemisphere?
Right? Yes, yeah. It would. So it would make their winter times 30 seconds longer.
All right. You can move to Australia.
Yeah.
Okay.
They don't really have
winter
down there.
They don't have winter down there.
That's true.
There's not enough land where it's wintry down there.
too much ocean.
Yeah.
We'll find a spot for you. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about rain gauges. Okay. So, I know what they are. How do they actually work? Because I'm thinking, well, if the rain is coming in on the side, how do they fill up on top?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there is, you figure out what the aerial cross-section is of the opening, and then you can adjust the collection device that way. So, if you've got a circle that's, one centimeter in radius, you can figure out the area over which the rain's falling and how much volume it should take if you get a certain depth.
Okay.
But the problems with the direction of the rainfall and high winds and all, it's not a small problem. And I think there are some ways in which that can be slightly corrected for, but if I'm not wrong, there's not a systematic solution to that.
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah. And I think it becomes a real problem as well in measuring snowfall, where they used to have those big basins to collect it instead of having a small rain gauge that maybe it's 6 inches in diameter. Mm. The snowfall ones are much, much bigger.
Yeah. And I think the best way to do snow, what I've heard anyway, is that you're supposed to take several different measurements in a 100-foot square area and then take the average of that after it's all done.
Yeah.
But when you're measuring snow as it falls, like they have to with the Weather Service, they use a snowboard and they just measure how much fell in the last hour and without compaction, without anything. So the numbers can sometimes be exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
But it is pretty consistent. So I'm part of this national rain gauge network. It's called Kokoros Community something Rain Hail.
Community Collaborative Rain Hail and Snow Network.
Whoa. Right. That's what it is.
Aren't you impressed?
I am. That is. I gotta say, that's not even out of your back pocket. You're ready with that.
Well, thank you to Joel for writing the script. So it was right there.
So if you're going to participate that, you have to get a certain rain gauge and put it in a certain spot, and they give you all those directions. But whenever it rains, I go and look at what was my measurement in comparison to the people in the area. And it's generally within a tenth of an inch of liquid precipitable water or less.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So it works out pretty well. Yeah. Although, I guess when I'm looking at people who are nearby, they're probably having the same wind conditions.
Yeah, undoubtedly, especially where you live. Yeah. Must be a problem.
So placement is really important, I would think.
Mm. Yeah, you got to be in open air, open sky. You don't want to be having trees block it and things like that.
Just 10 feet away. It really needs to be far,
it needs
right?
to be pretty
yeah.
open.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So those of you who have your rain gauges out there, that's what you need to know. And again, it was Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Work Network, Kokoros.
Yeah.
I like that. It's like you're in favor of chocolate.
I think that's why I like it. It's that cocoa part.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And so if someone is collecting that, how can they submit it?
So if you look up Kokoros, big C, small O, RHS, There'll be a website there, and they'll tell you how to order it and how to join the group.
Oh, okay. All right.
And there's a bunch during the state, and it's actually very useful, not just for weather and weather geeks like us who like to look at how much it's raining, but, you know, we're an agricultural state, and so with a lot of observations, if we could have a lot of observations in northern Wisconsin, then we can really monitor what is the precipitation and how are we doing with regard to water conditions throughout the state, at least through the precipitation part of that.
And the water conditions, are we still pretty darn low?
I think we're still in a dry situation. Yeah. We're not in a drought yet.
Right. It's not as desperate as it was, I don't know, probably in the earlier part of the wintertime. Yeah. But it's still drier than normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I've noticed that when it's raining, it's soaking in. It's not staying on top.
Yeah, so. Yesterday was a great example of that. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. John in Port Wing emailed to say that when he was younger, he had a local weather reporter on TV that always talked about the Hadley cells. As he recalls, they had to do with the location and track of low pressure centers.
No, not really. The Hadley cell is a global circulation cell that's kind of anchored out around the equator. It's a little north of the equator in our summer, maybe a little south of it in our winter. And it's a broad-scale circulation that responds to the intense solar radiation in the equatorial regions, sets up a sort of a thunderstorm belt that's called the intertropical convergence zone. And then it has circulations that extend almost to 30 degrees poleward on either side, more likely about 20 degrees. And so that's in the equatorial regions. That's in the tropics. So it doesn't have too much to do with regions of low pressure and high pressure here in the mid latitudes. They're quite separate.
So those effects just don't go that far?
Except in extreme cases. Okay. You can have influence of, you know, some excursion of tropical air from something that may have originated near the Hadley latitudes into the extratropics, but it's not common.
Okay, yeah. Great. Thanks for that email, John. We're joined today by John Martin, professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of the same department. Give us a call. Lines are open for some reason, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Remember, if you miss part of our show or want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives, wpr.org/Larry. Go to the archives and you can hear recordings of our broadcasts, and they go back a long way. We have some callers, so let's go to Ethan in Madison. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so recently in Madison, we've had a lot of rainfall, and honestly, the rainfall's been quite dirty. So I'm just wondering, you know, where is this amount of dirt coming from? Because on windows and on cars, you'll see after the rainfall, there's just streaks of dirt. I'm just wondering how there's so much accumulation of dirt in the rain recently.
Yeah, it was, what was it, 2 weeks ago, I think now.
Yeah, it
would have been. We had two successive substantial dust events from the southwest states, I think New Mexico and western Texas, that got involved in the circulation of a then-evolving cyclone in both cases that gave us rain. And eventually, like a day and a half later, and at the heart of almost every raindrop that falls on your head, there's going to be something called a cloud condensation nuclei, because the water won't condense at normal temperatures and pressures, the ones we expect them to, unless they condense on a foreign object. So if you've got a dust storm in the vicinity of a developing cyclone, it provides a lot of foreign objects that end up being nuclei for some of those drops. So you're exactly right. We had a muddy rain in a couple of different events there in the middle part of this month. Exactly correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So now he's going to have to clean his rain gauge pretty well then, right?
That's right. Yeah. Got to keep it clean. That's the other requirement.
Thank you for that observation, Ethan. Carolyn in Madison, you go right ahead.
Hi. I noticed a couple of extra low pressure barometric readings over the past, well, maybe 6-8 months. And one of them was like 29.04, way down there, almost 28. And is that something usual or unusual?
Yeah, those are pretty low pressures. You're down in the 970-ish millibar range there. That's the unit that I'm a little bit more commonly used in my practice. But that's a pretty low pressure, but they happen occasionally. Where are you calling from exactly?
Madison.
Oh, in Madison. So we've had a couple of storms this during the wintertime, especially late in the winter, that brought us a lot of rain where the pressure was pretty low. I'm trying to remember the one that was exceptionally low that might be the one you're referring to, but 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think, sometime in the month of March. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if our pressures were down around 970 or so millibars. Maybe it was March 12th or 13th, something like that. So, yeah, they happen. They're not common, you're right, and not at our latitude, but they do happen. And when they do, they catch the attention of the vigilant observer like yourself. So that's exciting for me to hear that.
That's interesting because I don't typically look at what pressure is. I mean, yeah. I'm always looking at the pressure gradient because that's going to influence what the wind is or define what the wind is. So I'll have to start looking at what is the pressure, actually.
Sometimes we can get really low. I think the lowest all time that since I've lived here anyway, 31 years of living here, has been something in the high 960s. And so that's
pretty low.
Yeah, it's pretty low. That's going to be 28.7 or so inches of mercury. That's well below the one you're talking about, but in the same league of rarity.
Yeah.
I thought you were going on. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
So for those that aren't really up on all this weather jargon, what does that mean when the pressure is low? What happens or what can we expect?
Yeah, that's a good question. The pressure is low because somehow the atmosphere has evacuated mass out of that column at the bottom of which the pressure is low and distributed it somewhere else. The only way to do that is to have really vigorous upward-directed vertical motions. That takes the air out like digging dirt out of a hole. And in the process of the air rising rapidly to do that, you produce enormous amounts of clouds and precipitation. So the two go hand in hand, even though the effects are simultaneous but not one leading to the other. And so when you have a really intense low-pressure system, you have got a really intense circulation and precipitation shield that has corresponded with that development. So I'll tell you the honest truth. The exact correspondence between the vertical motion and the way the pressure falls to the ground is still an unsolved problem, and I'm working on it. And people in my field, in my sub-discipline, will laugh when I say that, but I will challenge them to tell me what the answer is,
okay.
And they can't do it.
So. Well, we will wait until you get that figured out.
So.
Gary in the town of Ween, go right ahead.
Hi. Great show, as always. I love the weather, guys. My question is, with all the cutbacks being done into federal agencies, and especially the weather agencies, I saw a piece in the Green Bay paper the other day where they're only sending up one weather balloon a day, and forecasting has become so much better and saved so many lives and helped our agriculture, because then people know what's coming. How can people who are normally brain functioning support these policies?
Well,
there's a lot there, but let's talk about...
You ask a really good question, and that is that you're right. Weather forecasting has gotten really good. And that's coupled with the fact that our modeling, our understanding of the weather, and our observation system all feed into making good weather forecasts. And good weather forecasts are not only important to agriculture, as you point out, but to daily life and to protecting lives. I mean, we're entering the severe weather season right now, and which means a lot of potential thunderstorms and tornadoes. And in order to do that forecasting accurately, you need to have the initial conditions, which means the current observations. And once you start cutting back our observations that feed those models, and in some cases going back to what they were 40, 50 years ago, you're not going to improve weather forecasting. So you're not going to improve weather forecasting. You're not going to, well, maybe you'll save money because you'll be cutting funding down. But that the damage that that could cause in terms of poorer forecasting, it just doesn't make any sense to anybody who knows anything about the weather.
No, it makes no sense. And it should make the average citizen angry.
Yes.
That in our country, we're a rich country and we're a responsible country. We're having a retrenchment of services provided by our government, provided by us to ourselves for no reason at all. And the chairwoman of the committee that oversees DOGE is from Northwest Georgia. And there may well be a disastrous weather event in Northwest Georgia today. I wonder how many people will be as rabid about cutting back on the weather service after today's transpires than they were when they woke up. And I'm going to guess the number will be substantially smaller. And they're also talking about getting rid of who comes in to clean up after a natural disaster, FEMA. We're going to just do away with it. The states can take care of it themselves. No, they can't. They cannot take care of it themselves. So we've got a perverted view right now in our national government. I'm desperately angry about it, and I hope other people are as well. And we can all go to the polls tomorrow and do something about it.
Okay, thank you. You know, weather forecasting is currently a public-private partnership. If private or commercial interests, you know, took over the duties of NOAA, what would the consequences be of that?
They can't take
they
it
can't.
Over.
They can't, right.
They can't take it over.
It's too big of an operation.
Yeah, right. It's part of an international network of data sharing, data collection. Agreements have been signed between countries to make sure this goes on. Agreements have been signed between companies and governments to make sure this goes on. There is no private sector that can come in and do it. And there's not a single private sector company currently in operation that doesn't leech off of the National Weather Service products and products by NOAA. So they're not equipped to do it.
And I don't think there's a private industry that would want to do that.
That's correct.
Because it is really hard to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, to maintain the observations, for one, to maintain the computer infrastructure to do the forecast, you know, is two. And number three, as John says, that data, once NOAA and National Weather Service produce it, is freely available to everybody.
Yeah.
So why would you want to take that on?
Right. It's such an obvious case of a government-run entity, the National Weather Service, being responsible to the citizens of the country, and private enterprises are responsible to their shareholders. This is fundamentally opposed. And yet, over the last 50-plus years, there's been an ecosystem that's grown that has allowed a public-private partnership that really works in our country. Why do you go around taking it apart when it works?
Yeah.
It's senseless.
We're talking to the weather guys today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can send us an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Bob emailed to say it seems that weather predictions are getting better, but recently have gotten worse. Bob says he's unable to count on tomorrow's forecast anymore. His theory is that climate change is introducing variables that are no longer able to be properly accounted for in the models that predict the weather, or the models simply aren't up to speed for humans' impact on the climate.
Well, it's sometimes difficult to parcel out perception from reality when it comes to these kinds of things. My guess is that I would have very strong statistical backing in making this statement that 1 and 2 day weather forecasts today are better than they've ever been in the past, without question. They're almost at about a 95% level of accuracy measured by a variety of different ways. That doesn't mean that you don't get an occasional day that is just dead wrong in the short term, in that 0 to 2 days. And that day is likely to have a longer footprint, a longer shadow in your memory than the 8 days out of the 10 that are right on target. So I wonder if some of the perception is clouded by that, you know, the fact that we all have biases about, hey, this didn't go right when I needed it to go right. Because there's nothing particularly influential about the slow period climate changes that are going on that influences 1 to 2 day forecast in such a way as it'd be systematically getting worse. And there's nothing process-wise, kind of goes along with the prior statement, nothing process-wise about that set of circumstances that would affect the way the models perform in the short term either.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I would put it as physics is physics. And as long as we know what that change is in the climate, and I know that to some that's now become a word you're not allowed to say, but we will continue to say it, that climate change is occurring. But, you know, even if you think about it, even in extreme sense, that Wisconsin's climate is always maybe more now what it was in Indiana or something. Our forecasts in Indiana are still very accurate.
That's right. That's right.
So as long as we know what that base state is and we have the right models running, I think we're going to, as the climate changes, the forecasts will continue to get better because methodologies are getting better.
Exactly right.
Of course, if the database of observations goes down, then we won't get better.
Yeah, that's right.
But that
also
won't
right.
be due to climate. That would be the political climate, not...
Right.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm sorry. I thought we had a call. We didn't. Greg emailed, what area of the country is considered Tornado Alley, and are tornadoes overall increasing in frequency and or severity?
It's interesting. The Tornado Alley question is really interesting. Victor Gensini and some colleagues down in Northern Illinois University had a really interesting study. Maybe it's now 2 years ago.
Yeah,
sorry, Vic,
recent.
If I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of the frequency of tornadoes in the spring has moved eastward. So Tornado Alley used to be traditionally North Texas, North Central Texas, Red River Valley, and in through Central Oklahoma and Kansas. And it's moved a little bit further eastward. And I believe maybe there's also a delay, a slight offset on the calendar, but I could be wrong about that. Now, in terms of the frequency and intensity, I don't recall those details. I was more interested myself in the displacement of Tornado Alley. Maybe you know, Steve.
Yeah, no, I don't remember the intensity. I was looking at the same thing, map of how it's shifting. And again, back to the previous caller, you know, part of that is associated with how the climate is changing in these regions. And so we're still being able to predict those tornadoes. It's just that they're shifting where they occur.
And we're just a week past the anniversary, 100th anniversary, actually, of the tri-state tornado disaster, Illinois, Missouri, and parts of maybe Indiana. 695 people died in that. It still is the greatest tornado casualty ever in the United States history. So that testifies to a couple of things when you think about it. We are much better at monitoring these things and giving people warning. Because the city of St. Louis, the city and surrounding cities in Illinois and further north in Illinois, were not bigger in 1925 than they are now. St. Louis may have been, but the rest of them are not bigger than they were in 1925. We just have a better warning system and a better prediction system. So it flies in the face of exactly the kind of things we were just talking about. We do better at saving people's lives today, demonstrably. The weather hasn't gotten less violent. We're just better at getting it pinpointed and getting people out of harm's way. And if we reduce those services, we're going to go back to the good bad days, which were 100 years ago when people died in the threat of tornadoes because they didn't know they were coming.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting phrase that I hadn't thought of before. Yeah. Weather isn't less violent.
Yeah, it's not. And it certainly doesn't care about you any more than it ever did. So,
is it more violent?
I suppose an argument could be made that it may be more violent. And that would be the part of this study that I wish I could recall. It might quite be the case.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Chris in Fairchild. Go ahead, Chris.
Good afternoon. See, I was wondering if you could speak to NOAA's impact as it pertains to national security and the way that that information is passed down through the Department of Defense. And also, if you could perhaps touch on how NOAA's impact or possible potential reductions is going to impact things like the ability for air traffic control and other transportation systems to be able to accurately predict weather patterns.
I'll start. NOAA has a broad purview. It's not just the National Weather Service. So it's monitoring the climate and monitoring how that's changing. And in prior administrations, the Department of Defense was very, very interested in understanding better, as best as we can, what's happening with the climate in different regions of the globe, because there'll be water and arable land issues that are going to arise because of changes, subtle changes and sometimes dramatic changes in regional climate. And that's going to heighten tensions between different groups and different countries in various parts of the world. The Department of Defense wants to have its pulse on all of that so that it knows what the players are up to and what the stresses they're feeling are at any time. It helps to make what's unpredictable already, human behavior, a little bit less unpredictable if you know what the stresses are. Now, if you start to curtail that monitoring situation done by NOAA, you're going to know less about those stresses. Therefore, you're going to know less about possible adversarial stresses between nations. You may know less about your own adversaries. And how is that promoting the national defense? It's doing exactly the opposite. So this is a really good question you're asking. And, I think the erosion of belief and expertise in our country, and it's been hyper-drived in the last couple of months, is a really dangerous thing. And it has lots and lots of interconnected pieces that none of them spell anything positive. So that's what I think about it.
And I agree with John 100%. And the only thing I'll add to that is it's not just the climate that they're interested in, but they also go to the National Weather Service for weather. So when the Department of Defense has ships in the ocean, they want to know where those storms are. They want to know what tsunamis are doing. And those are all things that NOAA picks up. They don't just do the weather forecasting of the atmosphere. They do the ocean forecasting as well.
Yeah, and the Navy has its own numerical weather prediction. The fleet numerical is good model. But they don't rely just on that when they've got servicemen at sea at risk.
Right.
They're going to look at as much possible data as they can to make the best decision about navigation. And so that's a really good point, Steve.
Okay. Thank you for that question, Chris. So I believe there are five National Weather Service offices that cover Wisconsin. How is that going to affect these cuts at NOAA? Is that going to affect those at all?
Well, you know, there's by some estimates, 1,000 people have lost their jobs, right? That's 20 per state. So if you've got five offices in the state, that's presumably something on the order of 2 to 4 people per office. They're already understaffed. And I think that what happens is they have to, one of the reasons why the balloons are going up once a day at Green Bay, it's not a mandate from DOGE or whatever that thing is. It's a mandate from the people at the Green Bay office saying, here's our budget, here's our time budget. We don't have time to do this twice a day because we've got other things to do because we're short-staffed. So it's a trickle-down negative effect. And when the weather gets extreme, which, as Steve pointed out earlier, we're on the threshold of that season for our state, and the weather is important for agriculture, beginning right now especially, you know, it's just going to be a degradation of services. And I can't imagine how it will not lead to injury at a minimum and loss of life quite likely because of a lack of vigilance that we used to be able to maintain. It's just not possible to do with a shorter staff.
And you talked about farmers, too. I mean, they're pretty, they need to know what the weather's going to be. So mm-hmm. there might be less services there for them also.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So, John, you know, just to try to get a little lighter here, last week the Old Farmer's Almanac published their summer forecast. And as those of you who listen know.
John loves the John Old just, Almanac.
I will tell you that not once in my entire life have I ever looked at this Farmer's Almanac summer forecast. Now, I'll tell you why. It's partly because of my own bias. I love the winter, as Steve says, and Jill knows that, too. I love snowstorms. So I used to look as a kid at what's going to happen this winter, you know. I never looked at the summer forecast, perhaps knowing that it's such nonsense that it wasn't worth the investment in looking at it. As I've said again, people who've listened probably know, I love the Farmer's Almanac as a volume. There's lots of great stuff in it.
Right.
Just rip the weather forecast pages out. You know, just do yourself a favor and don't get your hopes up. I'm speaking from experience. I did it year after year as a kid. It's a waste of time and emotion.
Don't plan your wedding or any other event
Absolutely
around
not.
The Farmer's Almanac.
If you plan your wedding around the Farmer's Almanac, you are forestalling an inevitable divorce. Let me just put it that way.
Okay.
You're trusting the wrong thing.
Couples therapy right here at the Weather Guy.
It's for free.
It's for free. So, you know, the Almanac does do these forecasts, like, you know, for the whole 80 days out or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, how accurate can anybody be with forecasts like that?
I mean, I would say, like, going to NOAA and the ECMWF, where they have the models and the understanding, but as I still don't think that the Farmer's Almanac has said how they do their forecast.
No.
And so
it's
if you don't
magic.
Know how they do it, you kind of have to go by what you remember. And that's usually not a good thing to validate.
I think they're
something.
Proud of the fact that it's a secret formula
it's
of
a
some
secret
kind. Yeah. So give me a break. Yeah. But the answer is I think you can't do that. And
right.
people are honestly, I mean, in earnest, trying to make what we call sub-seasonal to seasonal forecasts now. And that science has really gained a lot of ground. Some of it's statistical, and there's some new influences. We have a new faculty member on our faculty who's an expert in the stratosphere and dynamics of the stratosphere, and that has a long-term influence on the troposphere. So under certain conditions, under certain regimes of stratospheric behavior, you might be able to push the envelope to 20-ish days of a reasonable forecast, but in other times you get it compromised to less than 10. And so 80 is just out of league right now and probably will be for certainly for the rest of my life. I would guess probably for the lifetime of the generation or two behind me as well.
Okay.
And not to harp on this too much, but if you don't have the base observations of where you're starting that
yeah.
forecast, you're not going to get better.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's exactly right.
Very true. We're talking with the Weather Guys, John Martin, professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Studies Sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Give us a call. Open lines, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe. Tomorrow at this time, we'll get a preview of the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo. And then we'll talk to the winemakers at Wollersheim Winery. There's been a change, and we'll tell you about it. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. But right now, we're talking weather. And we have a email from Helen. She recently saw Wisconsin on a list of states that were least affected by climate change. Any reason to think that will change?
That's interesting. I would have framed it this way, and I don't think this is what probably Helen read, but this is maybe a climate island. Our winter is notoriously horrible, and it seems to be ameliorating a little bit. Our summers are never terrible, and if you get a few more days that are unusually humid, it won't be the end of the world. So I don't know. Maybe that's part of the reason why this is becoming sort of a way to think about the Western Great Lakes states. I don't know, though.
Yeah, I mean, I would think in climate, we're certainly going to be getting warmer with time. We're seeing that already. And that might impart long-term influences of what our winters look like. Mm. But did you just say winters are horrible?
No, I can have good. It's not me. That. I mean, not by. I'm trying to be the everyday person here. Okay. You know, I'm not reflecting my own bias. The winters are to reflect my bias. They're getting worse, but they're certainly not.
Well, I did see
getting worse because they're getting the less horrible.
Milder, yeah.
I did see in a list of places where people can go to maybe find areas of the country that were not as affected, you know, by fires and earthquakes and drought and whatever. This would be a good place for them to go.
I think that feeds into it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, earlier call I asked about Tornado Alley, you know, so that would be an area where it's getting worse
because of climate. Right.
Yeah. Mary in Nina, actually, she's visiting Nina, has something for us. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, hi there. I'm visiting from Kona, Hawaii.
I love Kona.
Thanks. I do too. But I did raise my kids around Nina and listen to this program all the time. And when this rainbow occurrence happened, I really wanted to call in. So I'm glad that I happened to be driving and listening. So, you know, I frequently see rainbows. Our home is looked out over the ocean, and at one point I was watching a rainbow. It formed, and this was the first time I'd ever seen a rainbow where, as I looked up again to check it out, it had literally gotten flat along the ocean. So I could still see it, but it was flat, and it was on the water. And how does that happen?
So was the sun on the horizon or just below the horizon?
No, it was probably around 11 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
So
then
midday. And
so associated with rainbows, and we see a lot of those in Hawaii, the rainbow state, as you point out. But in addition to that, you can get other things that look like rainbows, and they're associated with how light interacts not just with water droplets but ice crystals. And so if you've probably seen halos around the sun, and sometimes you see sun dogs off to the side. There are also tangential arcs. So I'm betting you were probably seeing something like that, a tangential arc, which is usually pretty thin and above and below where the sun is.
You going to agree with that, John?
Yeah, I've seen a whole bunch of pictures of them. Steve's a real expert on this. I've seen some of the pictures of some of this stuff, and there's a tremendous variety of these optical phenomena. Mm-hmm. But I think the tangential arc is right. I think that's right on target.
Steve, what is it about the Hawaiian Islands that causes so many rainbows?
To get a rainbow, what you want is some precipitation, and they get precipitation. A lot of times it's fallen from small cumulus clouds. You want, and because of that, you now have a lot of open sky for the sunlight to go through. And you want to have a lot of sunlight, and they're much further south than we are, so they have more sunlight. And if it can hit to the bottom of the weather, bottom of the clouds where the raindrops are falling, then you get to see those right conditions to see it.
Oh, great. Well,
big raindrops, too. Don't they have super new rainbows?
And you want
a little
big,
more?
Right,
yeah, they have these big warm cloud raindrops.
You know what they do with bad rainbows?
No.
I know. They send them to prison.
They send them to prison.
Very nice.
It's usually a light
sentence.
So they have time to reflect.
Man, that's worse than spam right there.
That is lovely. You can keep them coming, Steve. I appreciate it.
The only one I have.
Mary, thank you so much for calling in, and welcome back to Wisconsin for a little bit. Let's go to Dean in Evergreen, Colorado. Go ahead, Dean.
Hi, folks. Great having you on again. Every end of the month, it's so great to talk about weather and related phenomenon. I had a question, and this is sort of like feeds back to what you were early talking about on the issue of NOAA services. We're going up to Lake Superior for the summer to go sailing, and so we really depend upon a good forecast, especially out on the open water. Some little nuances are appearing, and I was wondering if you guys had heard about photo evaporation, and that was, I think, a research study from MIT a year or two ago that indicated there was another mechanism for evaporation, which is particularly important for clouds, and I was wondering if some of that, what your knowledge is of that particular phenomenon.
I've not heard of that.
No, I haven't either. I mean, evaporation, particularly when you think about it over the Lake St. Louis, the way that I think about it is there's a pressure difference between the water vapor just over the water and the water vapor concentration over the water, the vapor pressure difference between over the water and in the atmosphere above. Part of that's driven by solar heating. And so when you said that photo evaporation, that's the thing that came to my mind, but I'm not sure. It's not a phrase I've heard before.
Me either, yeah. I'm unfamiliar with that. Yeah.
All right, well, maybe you can look it up for next time.
Yeah.
You can do it, Steve. You're not doing anything.
I'm retired now.
Don't let him fool you. He's busy.
I'll bet he is. Thank you, Dean. Appreciate that. John in Green Bay, you go right ahead.
Okay, hello. Yes, I've got two questions. The first is when they say that there's 10 miles visibility. Is there somebody that pokes their head out the window and looks at a target 10 miles away?
Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
They also have light detectors, too. But a lot of times it's, right, you have markers of buildings or trees or something, and based on how that is, that's how you do the visual.
My brother was an Air Force weather observer, and he was down at McCord outside Tacoma, and they had Mount Rainier, and that was perfect, he said. I mean, it took no time to get a sense of the lay of the land for visibility. If you can see certain structures on the mountain or in its vicinity, it was 8, it was 6, it was 10 miles.
Yeah,
that's how they do it.
From that specific spot, right?
That's right.
Who decides on what spots that are used for that?
I think, again, it's related to the issue we were saying before with snowfall, is that if you have other multiple spots around, then you'll look at them in general.
I think that's right.
And a lot of times the visibility is reported in a category.
Yes, right. That's also true.
Not just 10.1 miles or something. And did he have a second question?
No.
Yeah.
Oh.
When they say there's tomorrow will be a 50% chance of rain, I thought that always meant that there was a 50-50 chance it was going to rain tomorrow. But somebody told me that, no, that's not the case. It means that 50% of the area will have rain tomorrow. Is that the case?
I think that is the case, that 50% of the forecast area, and each Weather Service office has several zones that they forecast for, and so I think that is the case. And they're not so large that it almost isn't an equivalent statement, but it's not quite an equivalent statement. Mm-hmm. If you live in one that borders the lake, like if you're in Milwaukee County or something, 50% chance of rain in Milwaukee County this afternoon probably means if you're near the lake, you got a better chance than if you're far on the western side of the county, because the lake breeze will almost surely bring you a drop of rain with its cumulus clouds. But, there is some distinction to be made there.
Okay, great. Thanks for grabbing that extra question, Steve. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Claire in Sauk County, go right ahead.
Hi, Jill. Thank you. This is a weird question, I know, but Devil's Lake, of course, was formed glacially. Is it possible there's still glacial water in Devil's Lake, or has it all evaporated? There's no natural outlet to the lake, I should add.
That's a good question.
That's a really good question.
That's a really good question. It's also a skinny, pretty small lake. You can look at the whole thing at once. And so, you know, the first thing that came to my mind is, how do you overturn the lake? And you could do it with strong winds so that you get some of the lake water at the bottom. How deep is Devil's Lake? Is it hundreds of feet deep?
It's pretty deep.
Yeah.
So you got to get that water that's hundreds of feet deep to the surface to be able to evaporate.
And
that might not
wind.
Be an easy job to do with the small profile that it presents to the surface. Yeah, I don't know. That's a really good question.
I'm sure our limnologist friends will now email us.
In fact, I suppose they could test it by some sort of isotope analysis. Go down all the way to the bottom, take water down there. Has it got a different chemical constitution than the water at the top?
Yeah.
You could figure that out. That is really a cool question.
Yeah, that is.
That sounds like a nice idea for a thesis.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. It'd be a fun thing to do. It's a beautiful area up there.
Yeah.
And as she was pointing out, it's an amazing place in that there's no outlet.
Yeah,
It's like either rain either comes in or it evaporates.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. How do you like that?
Well, thank you, Claire. We really appreciate that. You got the guys guessing. Now let's go to Carol. She's between Rhinelander and Minocqua. Go ahead,
Hello?
Carol. Yep, go right ahead.
Hey, Steve Ackerman, you know me. This is Carol Rosenberg from a variety of classes.
Yes, from working with you. With, you're a teacher, right? Or were?
I'm a retired teacher, yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah. And it was really cool to hear you responding to that other caller about the things that she saw in the sky. And I had a wonderful experience with a 22-degree halo that I saw when I was driving between Rhinelander and Marshfield. And one of the things I do in my retirement is I am historian for Wisconsin Society of Science Teachers, and I immediately was inspired to write my newsletter article about that. And there's a great book by Bob Greenler, who you may also know. He was a physics professor at UW-Milwaukee, wrote a book called Halos, Rainbows, and Glories. It tells the story of all of those kinds of things, which are so fun to see.
Yeah, and I have that same book, and it's really explained really nicely. And so I'm thinking back to our caller from Hawaii. She might want to look and take a look at that book and see if he, because he has some good photos in there as well. And she might be able to identify what she was seeing in relation to some of the optical phenomena he talks about.
Okay, well, thank you, Carol. We really appreciate that. So I have heard from sources that Devil's Lake is 46 to 47 feet deep, depending on who you ask.
Okay, that's probably not then going to be deep enough to keep some of that water from, thousands of years ago, I would guess. It probably gets overturned.
Overturn that at some point.
But the frequency of overturn is an interesting question. I don't know how they make an estimate of that based on dimensions of the lake.
Yeah.
Somebody probably knows how.
Probably. In case anybody wants to know, according to the internet, Wisconsin's deepest natural inland lake is, you want to guess?
Lake Winnebago.
Nope, Green Lake.
Really? Wow.
Green Lake.
Mm-hmm. Never would have guessed that.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
How deep is it?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Oh, come on.
More than 47 feet.
It's more than 47,
237
Whoa!
Feet.
Whoa! That's stunning. That is
I would have got that multiple choice for all.
Me too. Wow.
Wow. And apparently, Wazi Lake, which is man-made, is 355 feet deep.
Whoa.
Ooh,
Wazi Lake.
That's very deep.
Jeff, what's he doing? He's digging a hole. Oh, apparently.
Well,
come on, that's pretty good.
Well, we would have come across some dinosaurs if there had been some, I'm sure. Wow. So, I've also been told, that the Almanac says that the Earth's weather is heavily influenced by sunspots. What do you think about that?
That theory had a lot of credence to it some time ago. I think it's been proven to not really have much influence. Is
and
that
and
right?
I think the reason why it had some credence back many years ago, one is the number of sunspots does indicate how much solar radiation, particularly higher energy solar radiation, comes from the sun. Whether it intercepts the planet is another thing.
Mm.
But they run in a 22-year cycle.
Mm.
And I think there was some studies, in the early 40s or 50s that were looking at trying to figure out what kind of cycles does the weather have. And so they were trying to correlate that 22-year cycle to some cycles that we were seeing in weather.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's ever been rigorously proven.
Kind of a little bit of a crackpot idea, seems like.
Something you would see in Farmer's Almanac about weather.
Exactly right. It fits perfectly. perfectly in the headlines of the almanac. Yeah.
Just so you know, this is Stephen John's opinion. This is not the opinion of WPR.
And as John says, he reads it. He just doesn't read the
just
weather.
The weather part.
Just stay away from that.
Stay away. Yep. Plants by the moon, but he's not going.
they got great historical stuff. Oh, calendar and what happened on this day. It's just fascinating. But don't look at it for the weather.
So speaking of the sunspots, now Northern Lights. We had a pretty nice season of Northern Lights. Are they coming back? Do you know? Is that?
I don't know if there's predictions. I mean, I monitor NOAA, puts out a forecast about whether or not there are high energy activity coming from the sun heading towards our way. And whether or not it's going to be a minor, major, or just a regular event. And I look at that every week when it comes out and looks for the major event. Mm. Anything other than that, then I figure we're not going to see.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for being with us again today. We always look forward to it. Steve Ackerman is the former Vice Chancellor of Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Services. John Martin is a professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Thank you so much for listening today. Thanks to our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. And of course, Larry Mueller. I'm Jill Nadeau, executive producer. Thanks for listening.